now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I will talk about a few different subjects. Well, one of them will be the latest false flag Syrian government gas attack, chemical weapons attack on its own people. It's a replay of the 2013 false flag attack when rebels under the control of NATO and the West and the U.S. launched a chemical weapons attack on innocent people, thereby producing a predictable hue and cry in the controlled world media. Well, today, unfortunately, a chemical weapons attack of some kind was launched on people, including children, in Syria, which the Western media was quick to blame on Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, and I will get into that in a moment, because I really believe it's an effort on the part of the powers that be to raise the ante, to raise the stakes, to shoot for all the marbles. This coming on the heels of the terrorist bombing of a train in St. Petersburg, Russia, So Russia is clearly behind the eight ball. The powers that be clearly want to turn this into a wider war, and I'll get into that in a little bit. I'm also going to talk about World War II history, real World War II history, not the canned, the good guys, you know, wear white hats. We see the white hats, the white helmets in Syria these days, right? Because George Clooney has made a Netflix film documentary about the white helmets, and these guys are part of the whole psyops intelligence apparatus there in the Middle East that's doing everything it can to blame everything on Assad so they can justify deeper military involvement. What I was going to talk about was aspects of World War II that your average establishment historian would not touch with a 10-foot pole. This is information that is readily available to anyone who seeks it out. It's there, yet not one of these establishment historians are willing to talk about these subjects. If they do, they just throw out the usual fog of war, friction of war, incompetence, mistakes, etc., etc., never suggesting for a moment that what I'm going to be talking about were deliberately planned, deliberately designed to prolong World War II, just as World War I was unnecessarily prolonged long enough for the Americans to get involved. And I'll get to that in a moment. I can't help but feel that Planet X, the second sun, Nibiru, whatever anyone wants to call it, is playing a role in this, in driving these events from behind the scenes. I've been looking at some of the video put up by some of what I consider to be the top Planet X Second Sun researchers on YouTube. People like Prep Ozzy, who has made a number of videos, some quite compelling. I've seen some good Planet X video. I've seen Planet X, the Second Sun, with my own eyes. It's real. It's there. And we're having more and more seismic and volcanic activity around the world, not just volcanoes blowing their top and erupting, but spewing ash, spewing steam, which is maybe a precursor towards eruptions. We'll have to wait and see, but I think there's something like up to 60 or more volcanoes that are currently active right now. That's a lot of bloody volcanoes. And we know that the powers that be are aware of these celestially driven cataclysms, that they are cyclical and they do come around every once in a while. They must know the presence of Planet X, the second sun. So I would encourage my listeners to check out the videos of Prep Aussie and some of the others, Prep Aussie, A-U-S-S-I-E, first word Prep, P-R-E-P. He's got 310 videos and counting, and he's done terrific work as far as Planet X, the second sun, etc. is concerned. He's got a video I have yet to see. I'm going to check it out soon. It's about the Earth's tilting, how it's tilted over maybe as far as 25 degrees. So I just had Sandra Fecht and Fran Toes on the show, the Cosmic Switchboard, and they agreed with me. They know the sun no longer rises and sets in the same place in the sky anymore, right? So that's something that we have to consider. So Planet X, volcanic eruptions, volcanic activity, may be, along with other things, driving this agenda on the surface. It must be understood that all these machinations and these false flag events and these bloodlettings that were done in order to justify a larger war, this has been going on for a long, long time. So I'm going to talk about a few things that happened during World War II. For some of you that have heard me talk about these things, please forgive me and just kind of tune out this next part. But I believe it's germane to what's happening today, because by pulling off this false flag attack in Syria and blaming it on Assad and Assad's forces, this is directly accusing Russia of being complicit in this. So I'm going to delve into a bit of my own analysis about the false flag Syrian gas, poison gas, sarin nerve agent attack. It's being incorrectly, unfairly, falsely blamed on Assad. Really just a justification to expand the war in Syria and perhaps embroil Russia and maybe even China in a larger war. Again, like I said at the outset, it seems to me that the children that are in the pictures, they're really children and they're really dead. This doesn't seem to be one of those hoaxed events where no one was killed. There were just a bunch of false flag, crisis actors running around acting hysterical or screaming into cell phones. This seems to be an event that has cost the lives of real people and real children. And then to up the ante further, they went and claimed that some of the hospitals where these victims were being treated was struck by an airstrike or airstrikes using rockets on the hospitals. Again, completely unsubstantiated. There's absolutely no proof about this at all. Okay, World War II. Operation Husky, in July 1943, 15th Army Group under British General Harold Alexander, comprised of two armies, the British 8th Army under General Bernard Montgomery, and the U.S. 7th Army under the command of General George S. Patton, Jr. Long story short, the Italian forces, with some exceptions, but the Italian forces were pretty much rolled up by the Americans and the British and the Allied British troops, because 8th Army was a polyglot army. There were troops from a number of different nations there. But after the Italian troops were defeated, the German troops that were made up the core of the garrison, the defense of Sicily, they put up a stout resistance as usual, and then they were backed up into the northeast corner of the island of Sicily. And then for 6 days, they conducted an evacuation, and they pulled out all their heavy equipment, their tanks, artillery pieces, vehicles, etc. Something like 100,000 German troops, an entire Panzer Corps, along with support units, escaped Sicily. Now, what should have happened was the Royal Navy under Admiral Cunningham and the Allied Air Forces should not have let that happen. They should have completely stymied any attempt of the Germans to escape. But that didn't happen, and most establishment historians are completely silent on this. There's not been many establishment historians who have taken Admiral Cunningham, the British admiral in command of the Mediterranean fleet, to task for allowing 100,000 Germans to escape across the Straits of Messina, which is a narrow waterway that separates the toe of Italy from Sicily. The Germans should have been bottled up in Sicily. The Royal Navy should have had every available ship, and they even had aircraft carriers in the Mediterranean. They should have been tasked with attacking the Germans as they attempted to escape. They created a ferry service with their ships and their boats, and they got 100,000 veteran, outstanding combat troops from Sicily into Italy across the narrow Messina Strait, the Straits of Messina. Where was the Allied Air Forces? Where were the... why wasn't the American and the British forces on the ground just hammering, you know, the Germans bottled up in their pocket? There should not have been that many Germans who have escaped, but they did, 100,000, and then that Panzer Corps played a key role in the defense of Sicily. That's a whole nother story. So when these issues are brought up, the standard establishment refrain is, oh, the fog of war, the friction of war, which is just is Clausewitz, the German military theoretician, taking his comments about the fog of war, the friction of war, completely out of context. And then when that fails, they use the old incompetence excuse. It's always incompetence, right? 100,000 Germans, along with their heavy equipment and their tanks, just escape, and they're not prevented by the Royal Navy, the Air Forces, right? So keep that in mind. And then you have the Italian campaign, a completely pointless waste of life and waste of time and waste of property. But it served the purpose of tying down large numbers of Allied troops in the Italian peninsula, which was ideal for defensive purposes. The German commander-in-chief in Italy was a Luftwaffe, i.e. Air Force General, Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, who turned out to be a defensive genius, and he had a whole bevy of outstanding combat commanders, German combat commanders, veteran German combat commanders, and veteran elite formations that made up the bulk of his forces in Italy. And what's germane to our story is not only the whole fact that Italy was a complete waste of time, and it was decided at the highest levels to commit Allied troops into Italy precisely to keep them tied up there, precisely so they couldn't form a second front in France on the French coastline at the time. It's a whole nother story of why the original plan to invade France was set for 1943, but because they sacrificed thousands of Canadian troops and some American troops, it was the first operational deployment of the Rangers, U.S. Rangers in World War II at the raid on Dieppe, France. That was done specifically to quiet the Americans who insisted on an invasion of France in 1943. And you have to read the book by General Albert Wiedermeyer. In General Albert Wiedermeyer's book, Wiedermeyer reports, he talks about how the British had conspired to dissuade the Americans from a 1943 cross-channel assault onto the French mainland and postponed it a year to the now-famous D-Day, June 6, 1944. And although Wiedemeyer doesn't talk about this, in fact, not many people do, I'm absolutely convinced that the raid on Dieppe in 1942, which was planned to be a disaster, because what a lot of the military types don't understand is that operations can be planned, developed, and executed precisely to have a spectacular failure as a result. That's what they're intended to do. And so that happened in Dieppe in 1942, and then the British were able to point, oh, look, we're just not ready to invade France in 1943, so we need to postpone that. Better yet, instead of invading France in 1943, let's invade North Africa, Sicily, and then, Italy. Actually, yeah, North Africa was 42, November 42, Sicily, July 43, and then Italy in September 43. And then the troops got bogged down in Sicily, mountainous terrain, peninsula, horrible, horrible leadership on the Allied side in the Italian campaign. But the point of relevance for this discussion, or this monologue rather, is that at some point the Italians decided to call it a day. The Americans had sent a secret team via submarine, HMS Serapis, disgorged General Mark Clark and a few others, General Maxwell Taylor, who was a colonel at the time. Later he would become part-time commander of the 101st Airborne Division. He was a counsel on foreign relations, remember. Anyway, this secret team had landed in Italy prior to the invasion of Italy in Salerno in 44, and negotiated with the Italian government to basically surrender, have an armistice so the Germans would fight alone in the Italian peninsula. Well, that's what would happen. Allies invaded, and then the Italians were no longer fighting on behalf of the Germans, and so this created a massive strategic problem for the Germans. So what happened was the Italian guards and the Italian military at the many POW camps in Italy, they just up and left. And they left upwards of 90,000 Allied troops alone in the POW camps. Now get this. And this is why nobody can tell me there was not a conspiracy behind all this stuff that I'm talking about, how all these things just don't add up, how a lot of it is just really a setup to prolong the war indefinitely. There was a secret British intelligence outfit called MI9. Its sole reason for existence was to help Allied personnel, air crews, and or agents escape prisoners of war, etc., escape from German-occupied Europe. MI9 was there to set up escape routes, safe houses, escape routes for Allied personnel who found themselves trapped behind German-controlled areas in occupied Europe. Well, guess what? Through the BBC, a representative from MI9, remember the same organization, a secret organization that had been set up to help Allied personnel escape German-occupied Europe, well, MI9 went on the BBC and in the clear broadcast to the senior British commanders of the troops that were left unguarded, the POWs left unguarded by the Italians, when the Italians decided to basically have an armistice with the Western Allies. And MI9, through the BBC, ordered the senior British commanders to keep the POWs in the camps and to post armed guards to prevent the British troops and Allied troops of all different nations from leaving the camps. right? This defies any kind of logic whatsoever, but only makes sense if you look at it from a deep state perspective, right? I read about this in a book called Shadow on the Mountain, which talked about the war in Yugoslavia and how the Serbians were, the Chetniks were stabbed in the back, and how that stabbing in the back continued basically to the demonization of Mihailovic and the destruction of Yugoslavia, the demonization of the Serbs, etc., etc. That goes back to World War II. And in that book, Shadow on the Mountain, it talks about this event, which I'm telling you about. So a number of POWs said, F that, we're leaving, and, you know, just try and stop us, right, to the British commanders who stupidly tried to follow the orders. Well, some escaped because, like I said, the Italian guards, the Italian military had left. They're out of the war. They want nothing to do with it anymore. So then it was their country. They were tasked with watching all these POWs that have been gathered from the war in North Africa, from Sicily, early stages of the Italian campaign, etc. But a significant number of those British officers followed those orders from MI9 and posted armed guards and kept the POWs in the POW camps in Italy, upwards of 90,000 of them. Now, for comparison purposes, consider the size of General Patton's 7th Army when it invaded Sicily. About 95,800 men, combat troops as well as support troops, rear echelon troops, supply troops, all up about 95,800. So there were 90,000 POWs that were held in these camps that have been deserted by their Italian military guards, because for them the war was over. But these stupid British officers dogmatically followed the orders from MI9, a supposedly secret organization issued through the BBC, right? Okay, long story short, then what happened? Those British officers, they posted guards and they kept a lot of the prisoners in the POW camps. A number of them said, F that, we're out of here. But a significant number remained, unfortunately. Then Rommel, Field Marshal Rommel, was ordered to move into Italy and take it over on behalf of the German forces, right? And before too long, the German forces came in and they started, to their surprise, they found all these Allied prisoners of war sitting in these camps unguarded by the Italians, basically only guarded by themselves, twiddling their thumbs. They must have thought, gee, we hit the jackpot here. They loaded up those Allied POWs on the trains and trucks and shipped them into Eastern Europe, Poland, Czechoslovakia, etc., where many thousands later died because of the incessant Allied air raids, Operation Point Blank, the grossly criminal day-night bombing of major population centers in Europe and Germany in particular. There was something called the Transportation Plan as a lead-up to the invasion of Normandy. It's a whole other story, but the Transportation Plan aim to knock out the transportation railroad network of Germany, of France, and the occupied territories. It was completely stupid because you would think that they would have enough foresight to say, well, we're going to need these trains, we're going to need these rail lines, we're going to need these bridges, right, when we invade and we start moving east towards Berlin, right, like in a normal planet that had warfare. You would think that they would plan and strategize that way. But that wasn't meant to be, right? So they systematically knocked out the whole transportation grid, pretty much, of Europe. And so when these thousands, upwards of 90,000 Allied prisoners that were found by the Germans sitting there in unguarded POW camps in Italy, when they were sent out to Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia, Poland, many thousands died because when the Allied air forces relentlessly bombed the trains, relentlessly bombed the rail centers, the bridges, and shot up with their low-flying fighter planes, shot up the trains, right? Didn't matter if there were civilians on them. That was beside the point. And this resulted in a humanitarian catastrophe because supplies, humanitarian supplies, medical supplies, food, et cetera, never made it to a lot of these camps where the Allied prisoners were kept at. And as a result, many, many thousands died. Now, stop and think about that. Some of you are familiar with the story that when 9/11 happened, a number of people were saying, okay, we're leaving these burning towers. We're out of here. And then some bonehead reptile cop popped up and said, no, you have to go back up. Now, why someone just didn't punch the sucker in the face, kick him in the gonads, and send him on his way, I don't know. But what happened was, because of obeisance to authority figure, even in extreme situations such as being inside of a burning tower, many of these people dogmatically turned around, went back upstairs, where they died, basically, right? All because one or more policemen told them that they should go back up. They were ordered to go back up, right? So a lot of these people have just lost their survival instinct. It was either never there to begin with, or they somehow lost it along the way. There was the poignant, tragic recorded phone call of a guy calling his dad and saying, oh, I wish I just left, you know, because he was ordered along with a bunch of others to go back upstairs, up back into the burning tower, right? Instead of, it wasn't even really burning at that point. I mean, it was smoking, right? And that's why they were able to get out of it. But they started hammering it with the directed energy weapons, and then all the charges started going off, and that was that. Excuse me. And so then we have this incident in Italy in World War II, where 90,000 Allied prisoners of war stayed in unguarded POW camps because MI9, an organization devoted to helping escape airmen, escape POWs, resistance fighters, Allied agents, secret agents, downed air crews, etc. It was an organization devoted to helping people escape, military people escape, and secret agents escape out of occupied Europe. And MI9 orders these people, orders the British senior British officers of these POW camps to post guards and to keep the prisoners there long enough for the Germans to come in when the Italians capitulated and the Germans came in and took over and then shipped the prisoners out to Eastern Europe, and where many thousands died. Now, 90,000 folks, people, I for comparison purposes, I mentioned that Patton's army, the 7th Army in Sicily, was about 95,800. And so 90,000 POWs, that's another army. That's a whole other army. Imagine another 90,000 troops injected into the futile Italian campaign. It might have made a difference, right? It might have made a difference, but Italy wasn't meant to be won anyway. It was meant to be just be a long slogging match to drain lives and drain resources and to suck these resources into Italy when they should have been, you know, I mean, all the war was a setup anyway, but really they should have invaded France at 43 instead of getting bogged down in Sicily and Italy. Nowadays, the establishment historians circle the wagons and they say, oh no, the Allies just were not prepared to, you know, invade France in 1943. And they always cite, surprise, surprise, the disastrous Dieppe raid of France, 1942, cite that as proof that the Allies weren't ready to invade in 43, because in 42, the Dieppe raid proved disastrous, like it was meant to be, because some of these operations are planned and executed in a way where they're designed to fail, right? This is what a lot of these people, these a lot of do-gooders and ones running around trying to fight Al-Qaeda these days, which they'll never understand because they're pawns in a game they don't understand, okay? So I just talked about how 100,000 German troops, elite Panzer Grenadier troops, were allowed to escape, basically, from Sicily. I'm telling you right now, if I was in command and I had no interference from any so-called higher-ups, if I was in command, not a single German would have escaped Sicily. I know that's a bold statement to make, but you know what? There's things like motor torpedo boats, there's submarines, there's warships, there's battleships, there's aircraft carriers, there's huge, huge squadrons and air wings of planes, fighter planes, medium bombers, heavy bombers. Oh, sure, some Germans would have escaped, but not many. Certainly not 100,000. Okay, I'm here to tell you. And that 100,000 played a key role in the defense of Italy. And I already told you what just happened, how 90,000 Allied troops stayed there when the Italians capitulated, stayed in the camps long enough for the Germans to come along and then ship them out to Eastern Europe, where many thousands of them died. So nobody can tell me that there wasn't some hidden hand manipulating things to prevent the war, World War II, from ending too soon. Because I've said over and over and over, the idea was to stall out the Western Allies long enough for the Soviet Red Army to move in, take over large chunks of Central and all of Eastern Europe, and turn it into basically the Cold War scenario, where you have the West, the NATO allies, good guys once again, and you have the Soviet Red Army, commie, bad guys, right? Oppo same, as David Icke says, two sides of the same coin. Okay, now let me talk about another battle. This time, two German armies were allowed to escape. I'm talking about the infamous Falaise Gap. F-A-L-A-I-S-E Gap. Falaise, I don't know how to pronounce it in French. It's in the Normandy area of France. And in a nutshell, by this time, General Patton commanded the 3rd United States Army. Montgomery, at this point, was promoted to command the 21st British Army Group. And one of the armies was a British army. The other, there was another army that was a Canadian army. And there were elements of French forces. There was Polish forces involved. Long story short, and General Patton and all of his subordinate commanders were fuming. Because first of all, General Omar Bradley, who had been promoted ahead of Patton used to be Bradley's superior officer, but Bradley was personally chosen by General George Marshall because, as Patton says, prior to the war, there was this youth movement where General Marshall was going out finding these useful idiots, basically, these do-gooder, obedient people with no real talent, no real abilities. Basically, they're just good at following orders, right? And so General Marshall went around and got rid of a lot of the old guard commanders. Somehow, Patton, you know, slipped through the cracks, right? Because he was already old by the time World War II started, by the comparison, in comparison to most of the commanders of the day. But Bradley was part of that youth movement that was personally selected by General George Marshall, Chief of Staff of the Army. General George Marshall, it should be noted, was a Rockefeller flunky. He was a Rockefeller minion. Okay, so let's fast forward to August 1944. The Americans and the British have two entire German armies, the 7th Army and the 5th Panzer Army, trapped in the Falaise Pocket. Now, when the Russians, when the Germans trap hordes of Soviet Red Army troops in a pocket, many times in the initial stages of Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia, the Soviet Union, the Germans would encircle and bag 100,000, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000. Just look it up, Vyazma Pocket. Look up all these different pockets in which the German forces encircled hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Soviet Red Army troops in the early stages of the war. And then also in the invasion of France, prior to Operation Barbarossa, the forces under General Guderian, the foremost armored warfare proponent, theorist of the German army, Heinz Guderian, he bagged 200,000 French soldiers in the latter stages of the attack on France in the early stages of the war, 1940. So why is it that the Germans can encircle and trap and capture hundreds of thousands of Frenchmen and several hundred thousands going into the millions of the Russian USSR troops, how come they can bag all these troops and not allow many to escape, but the Allies seem to have this problem in World War II? 100,000 escaped from Sicily, like I mentioned earlier, and then the Falaise Gap, where Patton was basically prevented from doing what he wanted to do, which was seal the deal, close the bag, and prevent the Germans from escaping. Everything possible was done to slow Patton down, to the point where he was basically ordered to give up his fuel rations to Montgomery, his arch rival, even before the Falaise Pocket formed. General Omar Bradley, this is the point I was making earlier, he was one of the part of the youth movement that was chosen by General George Marshall, the chief of staff of the army. And Marshall was an arch conspirator, intimately involved in setting things up so that the Japanese can bomb Pearl Harbor. Bradley, Omar Bradley, was junior to Patton, far junior to Patton. Patton was many years ahead of him in seniority and experience. Patton was the boss in North Africa. He was the commander of Bradley. He was the commander of Bradley in Sicily. And what they did was they jumped Bradley, promoted him over Patton, and suddenly Patton has to answer to Omar Bradley, remember, a Rockefeller minion, because he was chosen by George Marshall. George Marshall, again, was an arch-intriguer, intimately connected to setting it up so the Japanese can attack Pearl Harbor. And then even after World War II, General Marshall, by then Secretary of State, played a key role in basically allowing Mao to defeat Chiang's nationalist forces and allow and basically enable Mao to turn mainland China communist, right? That's a whole nother story. And so this Rockefeller minion, this Marshall minion, mediocrity named Omar Bradley, winds up being promoted over Patton. So even before the Falaise Pocket was formed, with the two German armies trapped within it, should have been trapped within it, Bradley was ordering Patton to send his a large chunk of his forces southwards to capture the ports in Brittany. That was a diversion of effort. And Patton used to get into ferocious arguments with one of his top field commanders, General John Wood, commander of the legendary 4th Armored Division. General John Wood says, we should be going east. Now, of course, Patton was not stupid. Patton knew that, right? Of course, all the forces should be going east. But he had to play the game and follow Bradley / Eisenhower / Churchill's orders, basically. Churchill and Marshall and all those clowns. And so a large part of Patton's army was diverted in pointless offensive operations into what was already becoming a backwater to the south and to the west, large ports like Cherbourg. At one point, Patton's own Air Force, the 19th Tactical Air Force under Major General Otto Weigand, was pulled out of the fight and sent off to aid in the Battle of Cherbourg, which was a siege situation. It was already a backwater. The Allies didn't need it as a port, right? It was just a way to divert resources, men, air forces, materiel, etc., etc. All the forces should have been going east. You don't need an atlas or like a globe to know that if Berlin is to the east, that's where your forces should be going. But no, Bradley was ordering Patton to send his troops to the west and to the south. Patton didn't like it. He had to go along with it. Got into ferocious arguments with the aforementioned Major General John J. Wood of the 4th Armored Division. He was forced to relieve Wood, unfortunately, because Wood spoke his mind, unlike a lot of American commanders today who just do what they're told. General John Wood, outstanding combat commander of the legendary 4th Armored Division, was relieved by Patton. Patton hated to do it, but, you know, because Wood was raising some serious questions. Why are we sending our forces to the west and to the south when we should all be going pell-mell for the east, because that's where Berlin is, right? Well, go figure. Anyway, all that happened before the formation of the Falaise Pocket. So Picture this. Two entire German armies, the 7th Army and the 5th Panzer Army, are trapped in this area around the French city of Falaise, and the British, spearheaded by the Canadians, converging from the north, and the Americans coming up from the south. If the two forces met, that means they would encircle two entire German armies, and basically that would be the end of the war in the Eastern, in the European theater of operations. It would have been over at that point, but no. The infamous stop order. Patton was ordered to stop his forces, proceed no further than Argentan. It allowed this huge gap to form, which became known as the Falaise Gap, and a lot of German troops, along with their heavy equipment, tanks, artillery, vehicles, etc., escaped the pocket. And to complicate matters further, they managed to get across the Seine and get to the other side of the Seine. So it was a replay, albeit on a larger scale, of when they allowed 100,000 German troops to escape the island of Sicily. Now, again, Patton had nothing to do with this. Patton was fuming, right? If Patton had his way, there wouldn't have been a single German escape that pocket, okay? See, the point I'm making is that even in wars that were conned into thinking are good wars, World War II is an example, a classic example. There is this establishing historian, Studs Terkel, who wrote a book called The Good War. And his thesis was that the Nazis, Hitler, yada, 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 you know, saved the world for democracy, etc., etc. And it was The Good War. That was the title of his book, The Good War. There is no good war, because the wars only benefit the Draco-Reptilian Orion Empire. That's what's really going on. The mantis beings, all these different interdimensional beings, it's all the loss of life and all the slaughter and all the mayhem feeds this archontic system and this harvesting recycling scam, right? And it's high time the human race wakes up to this. For crying out loud, it's only 2017. Take off the blinders already, okay? So stop and think about that. There's more examples, folks, okay? Because Patton could have won the war. I want you to stop and think about this. Patton could have won the war in early August 1944 in France. There were still the Germans and the Soviets involved in the Titanic struggle in the East. That was where World War II was really won, was the Soviet Red Army battling the cream of the Wehrmacht. The Wehrmacht means armed forces. There's a lot of historians who think Wehrmacht means the German army. No, the German army was the Heer, H-E-E-R. The German Wehrmacht is like the armed forces, army, navy, air force, right? So, but the Wehrmacht, mostly the German army, the bulk of it was in the East fighting the Russians, the Soviets, rather. So, the war could have been won in the West, so-called European theater of operations, in early August 1944 if Patton had not been thwarted. This is one of the many reasons why Patton was assassinated in early December 1945, because he had vowed to return to the United States, resign his commission, and spill the beans. And that wasn't the end of it. The deliberate manipulation to allow two German armies to escape a pocket. Remember, I just said that the German army made a habit of encircling hundreds of thousands, up to several hundred thousand Soviet Red Army troops in the early stages of Barbarossa. Guderian, in the invasion of France, 1940, he in his particular army, he bagged 200,000 French. So if they can do it, the Germans can do it, why couldn't the Americans, why couldn't the British? Well, the Americans wanted to do it, but Bradley ordered Patton to proceed no further than Argentan. It had created this gap at Falaise that allowed the Germans to escape. And those two armies, the German 5th Panzer Army and the German 7th Army later played a key role in the so-called Battle of the Bulge, because they were two of the armies that were involved in the German counterattack in December 16, 1944 in Belgium and Luxembourg, right? That was a whole nother setup, right? They knew that attack was coming. So it didn't stop at Falais. Later in September 1944, 6th Army Group Commander General Jacob Devers was prevented from achieving a significant breakthrough, which again may have ended the war in the West in September 1944. He was ordered directly by Eisenhower to not exploit his breakthrough, right? Patton talked about this as well. And then you have November into December 1944, the Hürtgen Forest, where regiment after regiment was fed into a meat grinder known as the Hürtgen Wall, the Hürtgen Forest. There was 50,000 trained veteran combat German troops in the Hürtgen Forest. The forest had no strategic value whatsoever. They didn't need to go in there, but they did, and they sent troop after, you know, regiment after regiment, division after division, 50,000 casualties later, right? And it was only the intervention of Major General James Gavin, who was the only senior American officer to speak up about what a waste of life it was, that they finally basically called off the offensive in the Hürtgen Forest, because they were preparing for the German counterattack in the Ardennes region, which they knew was coming. So it's just one scam after another scam after another scam. And look at the Battle of the Bulge. 75,000 American troops killed, wounded, and missing. That's just American troops. That's not British. That's not counting Canadian. That's not counting Polish. That's not counting all the civilians that were killed. Oh, we always forget about them, don't we? Right? 75,000 Americans killed, wounded, and missing. And there's still some people out there that don't think that they would actually murder 3,000 of their, quote-unquote, their own people at 9/11. That's a drop in the bucket. 75,000 U.S. troops killed, wounded, and missing in an offensive that the Allied High Command knew was coming. Let me tell you how much of a scam this is. The Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson, was visiting SHAEF, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, Eisenhower's headquarters, actually. And he was being briefed by Eisenhower, Bradley, and all these other Rockefeller minions. And Undersecretary of War Robert Patterson wrote in his diary, this was in his diary, he said that at one point Eisenhower showed him a map of where and showed him an outline of where they expected the Germans to attack and the expected depth of the penetration, where and when. Remember, intelligence is always about determining the intentions and capabilities of an enemy. And so right off the bat, that tells you, if Eisenhower showed Undersecretary of War Patterson on a map where the Germans were going to attack in mid-late December and how deep they expected the penetration to be, okay, that's knowing the intentions and capabilities of the enemy, right? And the apologists for Eisenhower say, well, you know, the Siegfried Line, which was the main German defensive line in Western Europe, was a tough nut to crack. With the Germans counterattacking, this means the Germans had come out from behind the Siegfried Line. They were out in the open. Now we can get them, yada, yada, yada. And you often hear his establishment historian, apologist, and Eisenhower official biographer Stephen Ambrose talk about this. Stephen Ambrose also wrote the Band of Brothers book, which they made into a TV show. Stephen Ambrose goes on and on and on about how when it became apparent that the Germans had indeed counterattacked, he made Eisenhower seem like a big hero by saying, you know, to the people in the conference, this is our opportunity. The Germans have come out from behind the Siegfried Line. Now we can really attack them, right? Nonsense. They knew the attack was coming. They let it happen. 75,000 U.S. killed, wounded, and missing, not including the British, Canadian, Polish, et cetera, not including all the civilians that were caught. What was interesting about the civilians, too, prior to the German counterattack in December 16th, 1944, excuse me, the citizens, the civilians in the Ardennes region of Belgium, that whole area of Belgium and Luxembourg, they were boarding up their homes, they were boarding up their shops, and they were leaving because they knew the Germans were coming. But somehow, Allied intelligence didn't know they were coming. You see, that's just, it's completely ridiculous, folks, right? Completely ridiculous. And finally, when General Patton was tasked with stopping the German penetration and cleaning up the bulge, the penetration of the German forces, it was only after that, in the aftermath of that, that not too much longer later, late January, began the great Soviet Red Army winter offensive. Surprise, surprise. Look at the timing of it. The Germans counterattack in mid-December 1944. It's not till late January, early February, that Patton, who by then had commanded 28 divisions, cleared up the German penetration. The Germans began retreating back to their original start line, and just at that point, the Soviet Red Army launches their long-awaited winter offensive. So the whole thing was a setup, and people think that the Americans or anyone else wouldn't waste 3,000 of their own citizens on 9/11. That's a drop in the bucket. Okay, 75,000 at the Battle of the Bulge, 50,000 plus at the Hürtgen Forest, allowing two entire German armies to escape the Falaise Pocket in August 1944, ordering 90,000 Allied POWs to stay put, so they wound up getting recaptured by the Germans when the Germans moved into Italy. The deliberate manipulation which allowed the standing down, basically, the standing down of the whole Royal Navy in the Mediterranean under Admiral Cunningham, the Allied Air Forces were stood down, right, basically, and allowed 100,000 Germans to escape the island of Sicily, cross the Straits of Messina, get into mainland Italy, again and again and again. And some people scratch their head, oh, how could they let all that Al-Qaeda and Taliban escape from Tora Bora? Just why did these Pakistani C-130 Hercules transport planes land and carry away all the Taliban and fly them out to, you know, Pakistan to safety, right? It doesn't compute if people think of this in linear, so-called logical terms. If you try to inject logic into all this, none of it will make sense, okay? So now we're going to talk about, and the whole point of relevance is the futility of war, because it only benefits the elite, and actually it only really benefits the non-human element that's controlling the so-called elite, because the non-human elements work through the elite. They are the elite, okay? So let's talk about the sarin, so-called sarin nerve gas attacks that were blamed on Assad. The casualties in Syria are real enough. One just has to ask why Assad would use nerve agents on his own people when he's winning the war a week before a peace summit in Brussels. None of it makes sense. In fact, there was a warehouse that apparently was loaded with chemical weapons, mustard gas, and chlorine that may have been targeted and bombed by the Syrian Air Force, and then they spun it out and used that as proof that, that Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. It's a replay of 2013, is what it is. Now, what's interesting is local sources are saying that the people that are the victims of this latest attack, nerve agent attack, and particularly the children in this nerve agent attack, were all kidnapped from towns and villages loyal to the Syrian government, loyal to Assad. So think about how unlikely that is, that these people that were kidnapped from towns and cities and villages loyal to Assad, kidnapped by Al-Qaeda, ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, whatever the hell you want to call them, those fanatical, psychopathic, reptile forces commanded by the U.S., Israel, NATO, etc. So the people that are kidnapped wind up being the victims. And then they spin it out and say that Assad did this. Global Research has pointed out, go to globalresearch.ca, a very good website. They point out one of the pictures, at least one of the pictures they showed, was a complete bogus picture, absolute proof that the sarin gas was not used, sarin nerve agent was not used. Because they point out that the people there that were helping the victims were touching them and carrying them with their bare hands. They were not wearing protective gear. The smallest, most minute amount of sarin, if it comes in contact with human skin, that person will be vomiting, defecating, puking, urinating, spazzing out all at once, okay? So no one's going to go around picking the bodies of people up that have been dosed with sarin nerve agent. Ain't going to happen. So those people were dead. They were really killed, and they may have been killed with chemical weapons such as chlorine or mustard gas, but it's unlikely that they would have used sarin, because certainly not in those pictures, in those places where the rescuers, the relief workers, whatever you want to call them, were carrying these victims without any protective gear. That's just ridiculous, okay? There's other things that militate against this being an actual attack made by Assad. Really just too many to name. Go to the websites Veterans Today, go to globalresearch.ca. And also, just notice how once again we have the bullfrogs chorus from the fake news outlets, CNN, all the rest. Wolf Blitzer, of course, Wolf Blitzer, screaming for war, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all the fake politicians from the EU and NATO and from Washington and all these other people just wringing their hands, and then also that so-called U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She's up there in front of the UN holding up pictures of the dead babies. I mean, these people have no shame whatsoever. They have no empathy whatsoever. The implications for this are ominous, because they're basically blaming not only Assad, but by implication and actually, you know, verbally and in the written word, in the print electronic media, they're blaming the Russians for this too. They're saying that the Russians were behind this as well. So again, Assad was winning. It wasn't a case like in Iraq where ISIS was, allowed basically to defeat the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army already twice slaughtered and decimated by the coalition of the unwilling. And then the U.S. military and the other coalition partners pull out and basically leave the Iraqi army, which had been decimated all these years of warfare, being slaughtered over and over again. And then airdrops to resupply ISIS and et cetera, et cetera. So now ISIS was not only driving around in brand new Toyotas. No, now they commandeered like thousands of brand new Humvees that were abandoned by the Iraqi army, the demoralized Iraqi army, right? And could you blame them for being demoralized after all this time? So that wasn't happening in Syria because of the decisive influence of the Russians and the stalwart military operations and execution of the Syrian military. Let's not forget that they've, really made a stalwart effort at beating back these ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, whatever you want to call them, rebels, right? NATO, U.S. supported. And Assad was winning. He'd gotten back some key cities, some key towns, key terrain, despite, all the airstrikes from the NATO forces. And suddenly, he's going to screw all that momentum up by gassing or using nerve agents on his own people. And then the media spun it out further by saying that Syrian Air Force planes rocketed the hospitals where these victims were being treated, right? They're just really, really, really pushing this meme, demonizing Assad. We've seen this before, the way they demonized Milosevic in Serbia. So the implications of this are ominous, folks, because it seems to me that they want war with Russia. That's scary. So we just got to hope that sanity prevails and we have help from somewhere, from on this planet, from underneath this planet, from above this planet. Not that we're giving our power away, mind you, mind it, but there are forces that don't want all this crap to happen, all right? We just got to hope that at some level there's some intervention to kind of throw a spanner in the works to keep all of this from spiraling out of control, because this whole thing, the whole thing could go nuclear in no time flat. Imagine if NATO launched an airstrike and killed like dozens or hundreds of Russian advisors and soldiers and civilian personnel. You know, Putin can only take so much. He's under pressure from within. If he keeps rolling over and letting them get the better of him, that's going to cause all kinds of internal turmoil for Putin. He's going to have to do something, right? So up till now, Putin has played a deft hand. He's not overreacted. He's taken a cautious approach. We just got to hope that this thing doesn't spiral out of control. I mean, they're already openly talking about war with North Korea. And see, Americans in particular are so ignorant about their own history, right? They allowed MacArthur to go into North Korea after the Incheon landing, September 1950, and then the breakout from the Pusan perimeter, basically routed the North Korean forces and sent, you know, most of them retreating behind, you know, back into North Korea. There should not even have been a 38th parallel. The division of Korea into a North and South Korea at the 38th parallel was decided at one of these big conferences in World War II. I can't remember if it was the Yalta Conference, Tehran, Casablanca. It was at one of those that they decided to, I guess, throw a bone to the Russians, right? But really it was to advance a long-term agenda to voluntarily allow the Russians to move in, occupy North Korea, and stop at a 38th parallel, and then the Americans and the so-called allies would control South Korea up to the 38th parallel. So that automatically set the stage for the Korean War. The late, great L. Fletcher Prouty talks about how he was in Okinawa at the time of the surrender of Japan, and Okinawa was being used as a massive supply dump in preparation for, it was never going to happen for a variety of reasons, mostly because it was unnecessary, but for a projected invasion of Japan, which the powers that be knew was never going to have to happen, because Japan was already on its knees. They didn't need to drop those nukes on Japan. That was just an excuse. That was being wise after the fact. Establishment historians say to this day that dropping those nukes on Japan saved a million American lives. That whole line was just a lie made up by the ghostwriter for Skull and Bonesman Henry Stimson, who was interviewed by the Saturday Evening Post, I think it was. And it was an article. No, it was an interview. It was an article supposedly written by Henry Stimson, Secretary of War, Skull and Bonesman, actually ghostwritten by Harvey Bundy, who was the father of McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bonesman, National Security Advisor under Kennedy, and also father of the other brother, other son, Bill Bundy, CIA case officer, Far Eastern desk for the CIA in the run-up to the Vietnam War. Anyway, the father of those two clowns ghost wrote the article on behalf of Henry Stimson when Stimson claimed that the nuking of Japan saved a million lives. It was nonsense. The Japanese were already on their knees. But back to the point about L. Fletcher Prouty, he was there and saw all the supplies being brought into Okinawa because the people on the ground didn't know any better. They thought that there was going to be an invasion of Japan. Most people didn't know about the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb development program. And so when, after the nukes were dropped on Japan, and obviously there was no need for an invasion of Japan, even though one was never really required, Fletcher Prouty asked somebody, well, what are we going to do with all these arms, munitions, supplies, et cetera, et cetera? And the guy told him, oh, well, we're going to need them for Korea and Vietnam, right? Most people didn't even know where Vietnam was at the time, right? It was still considered French Indochina. And this guy says, you know, if I remember correctly, Korea and Vietnam, or maybe even Southeast Asia. But the point of relevance is everything was already being teed up. And a big part of that was that conference. I can't remember if it was Tehran or Yalta, where they decided to give the Russians the North Korea, right? And after the Incheon landing, when, aside from about 50,000 North Korean troops that were stuck behind the lines in South Korea and waged guerrilla warfare, for the most part, other than that, the Americans and the United Nations, it was actually a United Nations operation. It was the first time the UN deliberately got involved in a war and invaded, right, a country, basically. They didn't have to go into North Korea because they'd already sent the North Koreans back to North Korea, and South Korea was able to, they were able to restore the president, Syngman Rhee, to the presidency of South Korea. He was another dictator, right? Another U.S. puppet dictator. But no, that wasn't good enough. So they allowed MacArthur to go into North Korea to unify Korea, which was not part of the original U.N. mandate. Original U.N. mandate was to kick the North Koreans out of South Korea and restore it to what it used to be. But no, that wasn't enough. They allowed MacArthur to go into North Korea. MacArthur made a number of strategic blunders, long story short, but the Chinese eventually intervened, hundreds of thousands of them swarming down from Manchuria. Right? And so the point of relevance is, if the Chinese would intervene with such force, sending hundreds of thousands of troops across the Yalu River from Manchuria into North Korea and thoroughly routed MacArthur's army. Actually, it was the 8th Army, commanded at the time by General, he was one of Patton's corps commanders in World War II, died in a car motor accident, and then he was replaced by General Matthew Ridgway. So the field commander, the 8th Army commander, was not MacArthur. MacArthur was, you know, in his penthouse suite in Tokyo, you know, trying to command the war from several hundred miles away. But it was MacArthur's idea to go into North Korea, and the State Department could have overruled him, but they didn't, because he was being dangled out there on a string. And unfortunately, once again, it was the people, the soldiers, and especially the citizens who had to suffer the brunt of all this. The Far Eastern Air Force is under General George Stratemeyer, dropped horrendous amounts of ordnance onto North Korea, killed millions of North Koreans, and they took out just about every dam, every bridge, every school, every hospital, every port, every target worth speaking of in North Korea. And that's why the North Koreans don't like Americans, because of what was done to them, right? So now they're talking about waging war with North Korea, which will automatically include China. That's where the point of relevance comes in. So on the one hand, they're, you know, saber-rattling against Russia. On the other, they're saber-rattling against China. It's like, when's it going to end, right? So anyhow, just keep all this in mind. We just have to hope that it doesn't spiral out of control, okay? And I can't help but thinking that, you know, at some level, Planet X is kind of pushing all these events along, because some of the recent imagery I've seen from Prep Ozzy, the Prep Ozzy guy, nowadays, this thing is so close, you can actually see the planets in the mini solar system, not just the brown dwarf. Actually, it's a red dwarf, because I've seen it myself, but the planets in this mini solar system, you can see them in some of the imagery, okay? Anyhow, you've been listening to Bartley's commentaries on the Cosmic Wars, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.